How's everybody doing? I'm really excited about this episode. I'm excited about this guest. It was cool to get him on, even though, like, I don't know, I worked with the guy on this movie that we did, this movie that just had a nice little run at various art house cinemas across the country and did a nice run at festivals last year. But I was excited that he was willing to come and talk about the movie and talk about the process on the podcast. We got Weston Rizzulli on the show, the writer and director of Riddle of Fire. He's also in the movie. If you've seen the movie, he plays Marty in the movie, Marty Hollyhock. He's one of the Hollyhock family, the Enchanted Blade gang. It's a really fun movie. If you haven't seen the movie, you're in luck, because it is available today as I'm recording this, as I'm about to release this episode, April 12th, 2024. The movie is going to be is available for digital download. So you can get it on iTunes. You can watch it at home now. If you missed the theatrical run, I am sorry for you, because it was great in theaters and there were a lot of 35 millimeter prints going around that I got to see it in 35 millimeter once, and it was really, really cool. It's a great movie. I really enjoy it. I've seen it 5 times now. I went the other night with my friend Diane and a few of her friends, and I really like this movie. Yeah, I'm a big fan. We're going to get into this interview with Weston and talk about the process for making Riddle of Fire. But before we do that, let's do a little bit. Little bit of review the review. This is the segment of the show where we read reviews on Apple Podcasts and we review these reviews back. I brought this segment back last week, and I kind of want to revive it if I can. So the way you participate in this segment, if you'd like to be on the show, you go on Apple Podcasts, you rate this show 5 stars, and then you leave it a review, and I will read your review on the show and review your review. So it goes like this. The first review that we're going to be reviewing is a 5-star review from CDub32 from August 19th, 2023. It's been a minute since I did this segment, so we got to go back into the archives. And the title of this review is Scat For Me, Austin. Not crazy about that title. Just going to start off, just let you know I'm not crazy about the title. And the body of the review says, podcast I've ever heard. I come from a moderately conservative family and often have trouble debating with them politically, not because they have good points, of course they don't have good points, but because their points are so bad it's difficult to fathom and dispute at the same time. Listening to your podcast helps me do that. Think you could do a little more scatting than you do? Thanks. So mostly, CDub32, I really like this review, okay? I totally get what you're saying, that, like, it can be hard to debate with conservative-leaning people, not because their points are so good. I really like that point that you're making. Not because they have good points, but because their points are so bad, it's difficult to fathom and dispute them at the same time. I totally relate to that feeling of being like, I don't even know where to begin unpacking how wrong you are about this opinion that you have. I don't even know where this opinion first began to germinate in your brain and how it got to this point. I don't know how you allowed it to grow to the point that it has. It's like debating a flat earther or something, and you're like, I don't understand how you have been this immune to information and knowledge, and how you have created a worldview where any information that goes against your flat earth theory, any, you know, clearly indisputable information, you just dismiss it as like some sort of conspiracy, some sort of lie that NASA has cooked up or something, or like the globe earth conspiratorial Illuminati has cooked up. I totally get your whole point here. Now, this whole thing about scatting, I hope that you're talking about just like musical scatting. I don't know. When I see the title Scat For Me, Austin, I get a little, I'm not going to talk about what scat is in the kink scene, but anyone who wants to look up what scat, you like scatological fantasies are on the internet, you can. I would not recommend it. I'll just tell you that. You can go do it. You probably already know, but I see that title and I'm like, what? And since it's a podcast. I'm going to hope that you mean just doing a little bit more zweet up and wee bop a boop a ga doop bop, zweep it up a doop bop boo, skip it a bop a boop bop, bop a little bop, skip. And I still don't know why. I don't know why you want more of that on the show. I just gave you a little bit, but I don't think I'm going to start scatting regularly on this podcast, but thank you for the good review. Thank you for saying that it's genuinely one of the best podcasts you've ever heard. That I really, really appreciate that. Let's look at another one. This is from Anne Marie QS. This says, my new favorite podcast. It's a 5-star review. It has to be. Those are the rules. And the body of this review says, I found Austin Archer through TikTok and immediately wanted more. Not only is he extremely funny, but he's genuine, vulnerable, and honest. He uses his voice to educate and point out the real disparities going on in the heated conversations between left and right. I hope he knows how much his contribution means to so many people. I, too, grew up in a conservative Christian household and always felt like the black sheep for disagreeing or questioning in the community. I feel such validation after hearing him address familiar topics in such an intelligent and human way. He is one of a kind, brilliant, funny, intelligent. What more could you want in a podcast? This is similar to C-Dub, who was saying that they grew up with conservative people. I think that there is sort of that – I think that that common thread runs through the audience of this podcast, people who have conservative roots and find a lot of validation in me – you know, unpacking and occasionally dunking on conservative viewpoints. And speaking of dunking on bad conservative viewpoints, I will finish this review of this review. Great review. Thank you so much, Anne-Marie. Thank you for writing in. I really, really like it. I give your review 2 thumbs up. It was excellent. I have no notes. But speaking of critiquing bad conservative views, I want to bring back the segment, The Bad Take Brigade. I'm not doing it this week, but since we're bringing back Review the Review, maybe next week we'll do a little Bad Take Brigade. But for now, let's talk about this movie that I'm in that I really like. It's called Riddle of Fire. It's just so charming and weird and great and funny. I've seen it, like I said, 5 times now, and 4 of those times were in sold-out audiences in 3 different cities, and I've never seen it flop. I've never seen this movie with an audience that wasn't with it from start to finish. I give this movie my wholehearted recommendation. It is available for digital download. You can get it today, April 12th. It's available for you. Riddle of Fire. This is my conversation with Weston Rizzulli, the writer and director of the film. Let's get to it. Let's do it. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a 1-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I am talking with my director, Weston Rizzulli, about his film, Riddle of Fire. All right, what's up, everybody? What's up, YouTube? How you doing? We are here with Weston Rizzulli. This is very cool. Our name's on the screen right now. I just have my first name, and you just have your last name. So it says Austin Rizzulli, which nice. Sounds like your name.
Kind of, yeah. Weston, yeah. Austin, yeah. Houston, yeah.
Houston, yeah. Dustin, Justin.
Oh, yeah.
All the Stins.
Cheston. I know a Cheston.
You know a Cheston?
I knew a Cheston. Went to middle school with a Cheston. Yeah.
One of my best friends growing up's name was Chaston. His name was Chase, but his full name was Chaston.
Yeah.
And I don't know too many. I don't know too many Chases that the full name is Chaston. But
yeah, I've never heard that one. Yeah.
It's yeah.
Yeah.
Weston is the writer-director of a movie called Riddle of Fire that maybe if you've been looking at my social media, you've seen me posting an annoying amount about. I happen to be in the movie, but Weston is the person that is the reason why the movie is good. So, congratulations, first of all, on just like how well this movie has been received critically and how well it's been doing with audiences and, you know, just that people really like this movie. I've seen it now 4 times in 3 different cities with 4 different packed audiences, and it's never been a dud. I've never seen it with an audience that was like, ah, like it's just like they didn't get it or like the jokes didn't land. It's like every single time I've seen it, there's a joke really, really early on in the movie where the kids are like, you know, they're loading up their paintball gun to go do this heist. And Alice does some like some like spinny moves on her dirt bike, and the kid and the other guys cheer for her. And it's like your first kind of clue that you're giving the audience of like what kind of vibe we're in for. And every time I've seen it, the audience seems to lock in and go, oh, I got it. I got you. We're having fun. We're having a good time. And I think, you know, so I don't know. I think that the whole thing is a real testament to your work and your strength of like and clarity of vision that you and also, you know, your command of just knowing how to let the audience know what they're watching from a very early point in the movie, you know, so that they can sort of like go, okay, here's the vibe I need to settle in for. So congratulations on all of that.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I'm so glad you've seen it so many times in so many locations with so many audiences. Yeah, it makes me super happy.
I've been saying this to so many people. Like I gotta be careful too, because like I don't want to like offend anyone that I don't watch things that I'm in a lot. Like I'll watch it maybe once just to see it, and then like I, you know, and I've been in a lot of like TV shows and stuff that I just didn't think were very good. Like that I watched the episode and I'm like, this isn't a very good TV show, you know. And it's like it's not all the time that I get to be in something that I genuinely like. I remember like I was in an episode of Mindhunter, and that was like the first time that I was watching a TV show and I forgot that I was in it, because I just was like, this is a great TV show. And it's because the guy who is at the helm of it knows what he's doing. David Fincher knows how to make a good TV show. And so I'm watching the show, and all of a sudden my scene came up and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm in this show. Like I got all excited to like be in.
That's
how I feel about Riddle of Fire. Is like, I keep telling my friends, I would be telling people to go watch this if I wasn't in it. If I just like happened upon this, if I had just gone to the Toronto Film Festival just to watch movies and I went and saw Riddle of Fire, I'd be telling everyone like, you should go watch that movie. It's dope. So
Thank you, man. Yeah, that's what I hope to do. I mean, I feel a responsibility too towards the actors to make something that is going to really like flatter them and give them a vehicle to look the best and kind of have the best sort of film that can showcase their work. So yeah, it means a lot to hear that really from one of the actors of the film. Yeah.
Well, I always say, I tell every, like one of my biggest laughs that I get in the entire movie is just because you gave me a good edit. And so it's like, it's when the kids kiss during the dance scene and my reaction face to them, it gets a big laugh every time. Yeah. And everyone's always like, oh, that moment where you did that thing. And I'm like, but that's not me doing it. I'm like, that's Weston hooking me up with a good edit. Like like the way that shot is, you know, the kids are dancing and you're telling them what to do and barking out instructions for them while they're dancing. And that's all one coverage. And then my reaction shots are a completely different setup. And it's just you going, oh, now they're doing this. And like, you think it's, so I'm not actually physically making the choice in that moment to react to the kiss that way, but you're hooking me up with a really funny edit that makes me look good as an actor.
You know? Yeah, man, it's directing. It's directing. It's seeing the vision, working with the actors, knowing what to choose. And then, editing is definitely a big part of it. That reaction to the kiss, that was one of the last things I put in to the dance scene. I did, it was not in there forever and ever. And finally, I just, because that the kiss is really awkward because we only did two takes and like they were both unusable takes. And that one, it's so awkward. Like, because Hazel, he like jumps up and he's looking at his mark. He's like looking down for like a few seconds, like trying to see his mark where to stand. And then it was always so awkward. And then that, but like cutting to you reacting with the like surprise was what saved it for sure. Like,
you know, what's funny is when I watch that moment, I don't see Charlie looking down at his mark or anything like that. Good. You know, I know that you see that as the guy who was like, and that's the thing too, that's really like, it's always hard for me to really see something that I'm in the way that, and I'm sure it is for you as a director too, because I can see in my mind's eye, like what the room looked like what the, I can remember where my feet were in the room. And I can remember like who was on the right and left of me, and the camera is not seeing that. So the audience that wasn't there is seeing a completely different thing than what I'm seeing. So it's like you're looking at that shot, seeing the mark that was on the ground that Charlie's looking at, but no one who's watching the movie, to them it might just look like he's looking down because he feels uncomfortable.
Yeah, he's bashful, you know? Or something. Yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
But that was fun. Yeah, that was really fun to direct. It was fun to direct you and your cronies on the couch and running around and like describing what's happening and everything. And was that crazy? Yeah. I mean, what was that? I mean, what, for you? I mean, was that because you have you had very little kind of idea of sense of what the movie really was, right? I mean, you kind of got that it was a kid. Did you read the whole script, or were you ever sent the whole script, or no?
So, this is something I want to talk to you about too, that I didn't put in the outline, but I actually want to know if you can tell me. So people, I've told this to a few of my friends that I've gone to see it with and stuff. I was originally cast to play Chip, who was the proprietor of the gas station. And there was a little bit of a longer scene in there. I think there were like two more lines where they asked me that we edited out. And I was driving home after it was a one day shoot. And I was driving home from playing Chip and I got a call from, I think Aspen, maybe the AD or even maybe just my agent. And they said, they're wondering if you can turn around and come back and be Dana as well. And so I just was like, sure. And I think you might've even said something to me like that day when we were shooting Chip, you were like, yeah, I wanted you to be Dana. And I can't remember. And I was like, yeah, it's fine. Whatever. And then I turned around and came back, but I never learned like what happened.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So, that was great. So your tape that you sent, the tape you sent was for Dana.
Yeah.
And it was so funny. I was like, it was of all the tapes, I watched it like 10 times. It made me laugh so much. Just your like simple like reaction to pedal where you're like, what? I'm like, huh? And like, it was so good. And then I was choosing between the like gas station proprietor and Dana. And there was this guy, because originally Dana, how I imagined Dana was to be this like really calm, like elegant, but sleazy dude, like a very princely like dude who, because I wanted him to be like the evil prince of this like dungeon castle. That was his vibe. And then the actor that I cast an actor, and he was kind of, he turned into like kind of a, he didn't want to wear the cost, or he requested a certain costume that he wanted to wear. And I was like, this isn't really the vibe. And then he wanted to rewrite a lot of the lines or his agent. And I was like, yeah, this isn't working. So it's, couldn't work with that dude. And then there was another friend, actor of mine, wanted to play the role really badly, but he's my friend, but he looks very similar to me, and we look similar, like we could be brothers. And I realized that so many of the actors that I cast look kind of like me. Like I made Leo Tipton and the twins, I made us a family because we look quite similar. Like we look kind of like siblings. And I feel like Alice, Phoebe Ferrell, has like similar face to like the twins and me a little bit. So I was like, I can't have every person in this movie looking like me. And so, and then I was like, and then the Jeff Johnson, the casting director, was like, okay, well, what should we do? And I was like, you know, it would be really cool if we got Austin back and did this thing where the proprietor had this other like secret identity as this like club kid dude. At the club. And so then I got both of the best worlds, which was to cast you as both of the roles.
I think it works really well. You get that added little moment or joke that's funny of like, aren't you the guy from the gas station? And like, that's really nice. Yeah.
Also just to like cut him real quick too. Like originally, yeah, you're right. Unfortunately we had to cut down the first scenes in the gas station because the running time is just so long.
Which and I'm totally fine with because I like the scene at the end so much. And so,
the kids, it was like, it was mostly the kid. It just wasn't working that great, but yeah, you got a more sense, you got a bigger sense of you in there. And it kind of made it a little more, obvious that you were from the gas station. But yeah, people have responded really well. And they're like, no, you kind of remember him a little bit. And it's like a cool thing. So
yeah.
I really like how it turned out though, for sure. Yeah.
Let's talk. I mean, this is also, I'm like going freestyle here because we're talking a little bit about casting and how you cast these people. I want to know about, you know, I know Jeff Johnson. Jeff Johnson's a guy I've been auditioning for literally 25 years. Like I've been auditioning for Jeff since I was 10 years old. So I know that he casts a lot of stuff that shoots in Utah. But I wonder how much of the casting, like, did Jeff bring those twins in or those friends of yours? Did you, cause like those, there's some of these people that I'm like, that's such a perfect, like every time those women are on screen, I'm like, they're just so perfect for the vibe of this movie. They look like a picture when they're driving that car, when they're standing over Petal's shoulders. So who are people that you maybe brought in or had connections with, and who are people that Jeff brought in?
So I brought in Leo Tipton. She is a personal friend of mine. Met her in LA years ago. I was dating her roommate for a while. Really awesome girl named Nora. And so, and I wrote the role for Leo Tipton of Anna Freya. And then, yeah, Andrea and Rachel Brown, who play the twins, are my friends too. We have a crazy story. We their older sister followed me on Instagram in like 2018. And then I followed her back. She's like a makeup artist. And she posted a picture of them and her, with her and her twins. And I was like, or her sister, twin sisters. And I was like, whoa, who are these girls? They're so magical looking. And so we followed each other. And then I had another script that I sent to them to like, I was like, hey, would you guys be interested in being a movie? And this other script had there were lead characters that they would have played. And then I was doing a road trip from New York to LA one summer. And I met their family. I met their parents and met them. And we did like, I basically wanted to do a tape with them, but we ended up just shooting a short film in their town, Manhattan, Kansas, which was like pieces from this other script, which is sort of like a teen comedy crime film sort of. And we just made a short film together in the summer of 2018. And then I was trying to get that movie going for a while, but then shifted to Riddle. And so I wrote the roles of the twins for Andrea and Rachel. So yeah, that's how I found them. And then everyone else, I believe, was Jeff Johnson. Yeah, he got Charles Halford on board when I originally wanted to cast a different actor as John Redrye, which kind of fell through. And he was like, well, do you know Charles Halford? And I was like, holy shit, Dana True. Or I mean, from True Detective, Reggie Ledoux, another French kind of name. I was like, Reggie Ledoux from True Detective, of course. And so he got him. He found all the kids. Jeff Johnson was great. I mean, he's a great casting director.
Jeff's awesome. And I think I think that the casting is great, top to bottom, but I just had a feeling when I watched the movie that I was like, if Jeff brought these girls in, then Jeff's the best casting director in America. But I was like, it feels like something that I'm like, that just feels so specific that like Weston had to have known these girls and been like, it has to be them because they're just so, there's something about them too. Like they just look like they'd be friends with you.
yeah, that's cool. Yeah, we kind of look alike or something. We have they're my good friends. Andrea's getting married in October in Mexico. So I'm going to her wedding down there. I'm super excited. Yeah, they want to be, we want to make a lot of art together. I don't know. We feel sort of like a soul connection. It's cool. Yeah, they're so cool. Yeah.
They're great in the movie. And like I said, there's just something about them that like they just put off a really good vibe and like they really work with the aesthetic of your film, which is very strong. Your film has a very strong visual tone and aesthetic and style that is apparent from very early on in the film. Another bit of casting I want to talk about that I tell everybody that I watch the movie with, I'm like, this might be my favorite guy in the entire movie, is the guy from the grocery store that comes out and yells at the kids in the parking lot. What's his name, and where did Jeff bring him in?
Yeah, he's a Utah actor. His name's Jason Wixom. Really funny dude. He had like a real Napoleon Dynamite vibe. His cape did. And then I was sort of, I he's super skinny. So I felt kind of bad casting him as the guy that gets like abused by the children and like shot in the ankle, but it was so perfect. And it was that day was so insane though. It was so quick that he went and, like, stood there. I was up on the hill where the camera was, and I was, like, direct, not with a megaphone, but almost. I'm like, okay, like, angrier, like, really, like, these little bastards, like, you gotta get. And then we did, like, two takes. He did two takes, and he was, like, out.
Great.
And but the leg, his leg that gets hit by the paintball is actually Aspen. Yeah. The first assistant AD. That's her leg. She stunt doubled for him. And yeah, she took the hit.
I didn't know that until I was moderating the Q&A in Salt Lake. And she said it from the back of the theater. She's like, that's my leg. And nice. I was like, what? And like, yeah. Apparently she still has a mark on her leg.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. We turned the velocity down, but it was still like, yeah, definitely. She's tough. She really like, yeah, she did.
I like Aspen a lot. Aspen and I have done two films together, but that guy, like you said, Napoleon Dynamite. He's also like it's like Tim and Eric casting, you know, like where it's just like the guy comes in and you're like, that's the guy. Like he doesn't need to do anything other than be himself to be so good on screen. And so like it's one of my favorite moments in the entire movie. But the movie is populated with characters like that. And every time there's a new character that shows up, like they really own it. Like when Colleen Baum shows up to be just the lady that Cecilia from the, like, she really rocks her little moment there on screen. Danielle does great as the mom and has so many lovely moments as the mom. Did you intend for that to be a funny moment when she's chugging NyQuil in her bed?
I think so. Yeah, I did. I was like, I knew it was going to be funny, but I also like needed as the writer, I needed to put her to sleep, you know? Yeah. So I was like, you gotta, and then, yeah, I knew it would be pretty funny. I wish it lasted like 1 second, that shot. I wish it lasted like 1 second longer, or she took like one more chug or something. I feel like to really nail the joke. But
have you ever seen that Vine? You know, like when Vine was really popular, there's that Vine of the woman who's like making a cocktail recipe and she's like, and then you just put two shots of vodka and she pours the vodka and it just goes glug, 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 glug. That's what it reminds me of.
It's so much. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Kind of like really like middle America vibe too of that.
She's not using the measuring cup. She's just.
Nope. Yeah. That's such a weird moment because she's so like sweet and everything that she's like, okay. And like, go take a nap, mama.
And she's got a half empty bottle of NyQuil on the dresser too.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of NyQuil bottles in the room. Yeah.
I need
to put her to sleep though, you know, cause that
for 26 hours.
NyQuil I use NyQuil as a literary device to put this mother to sleep. Right. So
it's like a potion.
It's a potion. Yeah. Sleeping potion. Exactly. Yeah. Cause because speaking of that, I mean, just from like a writing perspective, movies like this about kids on an adventure, you always have to cut back to the concerned parents that are like, oh my God, our kids are missing, call the cops, it's so frantic and so stressful. And it like really kind of ruins the vibe of the magic kid adventure. So when I was writing, like that was a big thing of like, how do I get away with not having to cut back to the frantic parent moments. And it's like, well, I could just put her to sleep somehow. Like
I chuckle every time the movie cuts back to her passed the fuck out. I chuckle every single time.
I cut a line. Yeah, there's that. It cuts back to her like in that kind of push in when she's sort of like tossing and turning. But there was a line that I cut, which was like, she kind of wakes up like groggily and she's like, oh, Hazel and Jody, my sweeties, thank you for shutting the blinds. Like, because it's dark, you know? But it was too much. It was too online. Didn't need it. Yeah.
Stuff. Okay. So speaking of the very strong visual language and aesthetic of this film, the look of the film, there's something I wanted to talk about with you being a first time writer director. I get really nervous whenever I go onto a set. I always feel like it's my job in that setting to like be of service to someone else's project. And I just want to make sure I'm not like ruining their project. I just want to make sure that like I'm helping them make their project and as good as they can make it. And I get really, I just get nervous every time it's my first day on set. And what I've started to do in my career to counteract that, and it I think I started this after I started directing myself. I direct music videos and stuff. And I realized like, oh, being the director, there's no more stressful job on set than being the director. So I don't need to be like, so where I, what I need to do is try to be of service to other people's anxiety on set. I don't know if you remember this, but on our first day, the first thing I did is I came up to you and I said, how's it going? How are you doing? Yes. Because I think my first day was the second day of filming. And I said, how's it going so far? And like, this is something I'll do is I'll check in with the director and just be like, how are you? Like, how are you feeling? Because I know that like, their world is like, I'm making 40 decisions a minute, every minute, and everyone wants an answer from me. And I just want to be like, are you having fun? How is everything going? And I want to be like, yeah. But like,
that's great. That's great.
So my question is like, if you were Weston Rizzulli, who has 5 or 6 films under his belt, and you're making a movie like this, and everyone on your crew knows the Rizzulli filmography and knows the vibe of a Weston Rizzulli film, there's something a little different in that where you can kind of show up. You might even have like the same team of people that you've already been working with several times. Everybody has a shared language and like a shared vibe, and maybe that pressure is a little bit lessened. But when it's your first movie and you're trying to like communicate a thing that's in your head that's really, really strong and distinctive, but also like not everyone can see it. Like your crew it's largely a local crew that is just sort of part of the Utah Film Commission, that they're like coming and working on this movie and staffed by their different unions and stuff. What is that process like for you as a first time? Like the talk about like the insecurity and how you kind of fight for your vision with confidence and stuff in that first setting.
Yeah, that's a great question and like observation and something to really get into. First of all, though, thank you for, I love that you check in with the director and just like kind of ask how they're doing and stuff. That's really nice. I think that's a great, great thing to do. Cause that's really good. That's really good. And speaking of you, of like just going on set and being nervous as the actor and like you not wanting to like mess up the vision or anything, I think you shouldn't worry about that, because if the director casts you, they cast you because you're you, and you know, they cast you to do you and to do whatever you do. So yeah. I would have faith in that for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the vision, so it is definitely kind of, so my thing, what I try to do is to be a director, to be a leader to all my crew and actors, and to be the creative leader is I try to, first of all, I do design as much as I can. I do concept drawing, concept illustration, concept design. I design a lot of the props and stuff, collect a lot of the costumes and things. And I try to be as like, I'm just naturally excited about it and confident about it as possible, so that other people can just have faith in that. Cause I feel like if you're observing an artist doing something, and the artist sort of, he seems like he knows exactly what he's doing and what he wants, and he can back it up with the facts and the knowledge and everything, then it's like, okay, yeah, this, like, we should put our faith in this guy's like wild goose chase, you know? Mm-hmm. So I just try to act as a kind of like an, almost like a camp counselor, like a circus ringleader, ringmaster type person, with the confidence and the visuals and everything. But yeah, there's definitely, there is like a big part of like, I imagine that 95% of the crew and people on set really don't know what the hell I'm doing. And like, they don't see the vision, which can be like a little concerning, but I try to just not let it bother me. And it's more of like, it doesn't really matter what they think of it now, but I can't wait for them to see the trailer, you know, and the teasers and the posters and stuff. And then they'll get it. Then they'll be like, oh, okay. It wasn't like crazy, like little kids jumping out of trucks. Like, I don't know. Yeah, it definitely. I also like to. I think of George Lucas making the first Star Wars, because that was a really like horrible shoot where everyone made fun of him on set. Like, and he was working in England, in the English crew, working on Elstree Studios in England, in London. Like, they hated George Lucas. They thought he was ridiculous. They made fun of him. All his actors, you know, Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill, like, they always wanted to, they were like, George, can we do like a goofy line? Can we make it goofy? And he was like, no. Like, do it. It's serious. This is a serious movie. And they're like, you're using words like Wookiee, dude. Like, it's fucking goofy. Yeah. Like, you're a joke. And they really, and he like got so stressed out about that. And then it's like, well, and then they got Star Wars. So I try to like, remember that and kind of have faith in my own, I don't know, my vision. And if people can't see it during the shooting, then I don't know. I think it's important that the actors kind of, they get it though, for sure. I mean, especially, and which they did. I mean, all the leads for sure. Like, they really got it. 100%. I think Charles Halford at times was maybe like, he was definitely putting his faith in me though. He was like, I don't really know like what you're going for, but okay, like, dude, I'll just give you a bunch of stuff. And he was like, he gave
you sound
me a
like
bunch
him.
Of different, yeah. And like, you gave me a lot of takes, you know, some were funnier, some were darker, and like, yeah, he was great. So, but like Leo Tipton, we were on the same wavelength, and like the twins and I and the kids, they got it. So yeah. But
The kids, you know, I think that like you just made it a really fun environment for the kids, and that's kind of like the, and we will talk a little bit more about working with the kids in a bit, but that's kind of what I mean is, In 3 or 4 films, people are going to be on your set, you know, knowing that they're making a Weston Rizzulli movie and what that means and what that looks like. I think about I think that happens with so many directors. I think about like early Wes Anderson or something. And it's like when he's doing Rushmore, which is really the first time I think he has like full creative control to do a Wes Anderson movie. Bottle Rocket is sort of like this proof of concept thing, but it's like to have Bill Murray, I mean, even Royal Tenenbaums, Gene Hackman had no idea what they were doing. Was like, what are we? I have no idea what you're telling me. Like, I just did a movie with Luke Wilson, and he had a really funny anecdote about Gene Hackman where he was like, he's like, we were doing a scene, and Wes kept nudging Hackman back so that there was this picture that would be centered between us in the frame. And Hackman was like, what are you doing? And he was like, I just want to get that picture centered between the two of you. And he was like, he's like, we're acting. He's like, we're doing a scene. He's like, we're doing a scene. He's like, what are you talking about? He's like, you're looking at the picture on the wall. Yeah. He's like, yeah, I just want to make sure that it's centered.
That's it's great.
Like, you know, Gene Hackman doesn't know what a Wes Anderson movie is. Most people at that time.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't Wes Anderson at that time. Like you're saying. Yeah. It's like, you don't know. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Have you heard the Statue of Liberty with Hackman? He was, like, they shot a scene at Battery Park, like on Lower Manhattan, and Wes Anderson had him, he wanted him to stand in front of Liberty to block the Statue of Liberty because he didn't want, and then Gene Hackman was like, what are you talking about? You're blocking the Statue of Liberty? How dumb are you? And he was really pissed about that, apparently, supposedly.
He was apparently mad a lot on that set, and it's some of, I love his performance in the film.
Oh, it's so good, yeah.
And again, I really think that it's just a testament to the fact that film is the director's medium, and a director who is confident and strong about their vision and their concept doesn't even necessarily need to have the actors on board if they've cast the film well. And if they have actors who know how to act decently, you know, like I think that when I watch Riddle of Fire, what I see is an execution of a singular vision. Like the reason I'm so comfortable telling people it's a great movie, it's because I don't feel like it's me telling them this thing I made is really good. I'm like, oh, I do things in it, but it's someone else's art project. And I think that person executed what they wanted to do really, really well. And that's why it's good.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think it's really impressive.
I'll just tell you this too. One of my favorite scenes to edit, if not my favorite scene to edit, was the exchange between when you meet Dana Troubadour, when the kids come in. Those two scenes of them coming in and Petal's like, Dana, and then when they come back, those, for some reason, those, I edited those so quickly. Like, they were, it just flowed like so well. Like, unlike every other scene was a slog to edit, but those were like, it just, because the kids were on, they were all on that in those scenes, right? And you're fantastic. So it was like, it was just, yeah, it was very smooth editing and very fun. Yeah.
Good. Thanks. I'm glad I could make your job in that department easy.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about this, just the confidence of vision and a style to, especially as a first time director, you really got to be willing to like take some stylistic risks. There's also a thing about like shooting on film and the limited amount of takes that might be available. So, I want to talk about reviews. I don't know how much you look at those or how much you care about those. I look because I want the film to do well. This is a very well-reviewed film. It's been very well-reviewed by critics. It's been very well-reviewed by audiences. This is a very well-received film. But I, of course, because I'm a glutton for punishment, I look at what people are saying who don't like it. And I'm like, what is it that they're grabbing onto? You mentioned earlier, like, the runtime of the film. This is something that I personally, I've made videos about this before. I think saying it's too long is one of the most boring things you can say about a movie. I'm like, you need to tell me why specifically. It's like, it can't just be, I looked at the amount of minutes that the film is, and that's too many minutes for a movie like that to be. It's like, no, the movie takes as long as it takes, in my opinion, to be what it needs to be. And if it needs to take 3.5 hours to do that, then that's what it takes. And I don't really buy into this like blanket criticism of just like too long. In my opinion, I think people are used to movies starring kids being like no more than 90 minutes. And your film goes like 20 minutes over that, maybe 25 minutes over that mark. But like one of the things I really like seeing it four times, there is a pace to some of these moments to where we're like really living in a master shot. Charles Halford gets up from the fire and walks away, and we wait the amount of time that it takes for Hazel to sneak in, open up the bag, dig through the bag, get the eggs out. A lot of people would want to punch into a lot of coverage on that to snap it up, to go like, he comes in, we grab the eggs, he looks, the eggs are there, he sees the food, like snap it up. You could make that maybe 10 seconds shorter. I really like living in the master. And this happens a lot in this film. I really like letting the kids take the time to do the action and watching kids behave the way that kids behave in a kid's body. Yes. Even if they're fumbling with something, maybe some of that is from necessity of just like, we're shooting on film and we have a limited amount of time or a limited amount of takes. But like, to me, there's something in there about a confidence as an editor and director to say, I'm going to let this moment play out and I'm not going to feel the pressure to trim.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
100%. Yeah. So first of all, a major goal with this movie was to get a pacing that allows the audience to kind of relax and sink into the world. I really don't like movies that are paced, unless it's really for the style. I really don't like my movies to be paced super quickly because I love visiting different worlds and getting to kind of like stay there a little bit and chill out a little bit and not have to like be like kind of stressed out because it's so cutty and stuff. So it was always, I always wanted to be kind of slower. And how I combat that from being too slow is I just make characters that are very kind of juicy. They're very like funny or weird or crazy. And also the world, I try to populate it with as much like beauty and interesting stuff as possible. So my thing is like, if the characters are interesting enough and the setting and the world is interesting enough, you can take your foot off the gas pedal a little bit and want to live a little bit in there. So that's one part. The other part is, that scene that you were talking about for like staying on the wide for Hazel to come in, when, you know, John Redway leaves and Hazel comes in, that, I left it on there. I think we did have coverage of him maybe coming in, but I thought that if I leave it there, it just has a little bit more tension. It feels a little almost campsite. It felt a little almost like theatrical, like a play or something. And I think kind of because it's like it's a scene where they're sneaking around, and so typically it's going to be tense. You have tension. So if you have a little bit of tension, the less you cut, the more tense it will be. So that's kind of that's why that's like that. And then, yeah, but um, Yeah, yeah. And then it was just written, like, it was written to be that running time. And then I you know, it was, I cut it down from, it was originally like 10 minutes longer, and I cut it down and cut it down. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of a journey. It's a, you know, it's a little long.
I personally hope you're not thinking in your head, ah, shit, I should have cut 15 or 20 minutes more. I hope not.
No, well, I tried to, because even like, I mean, so many sales agents wanted us to cut it down, and there was so much stuff that I couldn't take out and didn't want to. Like, for example, something that I could have taken out, and it would have been pretty easy to take out, which was right the opening scene when the kids are riding through the woods, and then they meet up, they stop in the grove, and they exchange the paintballs and the CO2 cartridges. That moment could have been cut. And then the riding around, that could have been cut out of the whole film. I could have just opened to the kids riding, that the Alice rides, then the two kids ride, and then cut to the three of them riding away, like they joined up. But that's what like a normal movie would do. And my opening is like, that's not the opening that I want, you know, and I'm trying to be a little bit more unique and do something that hasn't really been done. So, but it could have been, but it also would not have explained how the paintball guns really work. Cause I kind of, as someone who like played paintball, the guns have no hoppers and they have no real CO2 canisters. So as someone who's played paintball, you'd be like, how the hell are those guns working? This is wrong. So I need to show that. And then, you know,
well, and that's, you know, that's what I was saying at the beginning is like, I think that moment tells the audience too, what kind of movie we're watching.
Yeah.
Like I think a movie that like, that has a certain kind of pace, or that, you know, like I really like when the filmmaker knows, like, I got to let them know that we're set, that this is the vibe, this is the energy. That little moment there tells me a lot about the energy of the movie. It tells me a lot about the sense of humor. This is an incredibly funny movie, and it has a really, really unique sense of humor, and that moment really introduces us to
and some of the danger too, probably. Mm-hmm. And the kind of like mix of like innocence and danger with like kids with like CO2 canisters. Like, I don't, yeah, it's a bit weird. And like, I don't know.
You gave yourself, as a first time director, several pretty big challenges in making a feature. You didn't shoot digitally, which is like what 99% of movies are made today do, because you can shoot as many takes as you can fit on a, you know, 5 terabyte memory card. You shot on 16 millimeter Kodak film. I think another thing that tells the audience pretty early on the vibe, the energy, it's beautiful. It really is it's a whole ass character in the movie, in my opinion. And the other thing you did is you made your movie ride on the shoulders of 4 very young actors. So like, I don't know. Yeah. What were you thinking with that?
That's a great question. So I'm definitely under the opinion in filmmaking that luck favors the bold, and like the film gods favor film, and they favor the risk takers. I don't know. I love film very much. I've shot many music videos on film and short films on film, and it's just kind of the medium that I feel confident with using in order to pull off my vision. I think that film is like cooking. It's like, it's like butter. It's the best butter. It's using the best butter you have available on the planet to cook your dish with. So why wouldn't you use that to cook your dish with? Yeah. And I've worked with film a lot. So I'm familiar with the workflow. And I'm also a big fan of like creative constrictions, because I think it can definitely yield some more like interesting results. And I think it's like, cause every time you set up a shot on film, even like a little cut, like a little coverage of like a close up of a flower, like you are so much more specific about it than you would if you were shooting digitally. And that's just it's a way of work that I just prefer. Yeah. The kids thing was my philosophy was, if I find kids that are just funny enough to watch, just funny enough as themselves, and I give them funny things to say and make them do like crazy stuff, like shooting people and things with paintball guns and jumping out of trucks and like sneaking around, then that can work. So that was, I just kind of put my faith in that. And then, yeah, as you mentioned, my editing, that's also like one of my, I mean, that's just one thing that I have really kind of perfected is my ability to kind of take some sort of mediocre footage, but then like kind of make, like bring it to another level with like the editing and the music and the graphics and the everything else. So sometimes I put my faith in that almost too much. Like that can be almost a problem of how much I can be like, well, I can, if I just get this a much, I'll be able to kind of like get at least 80% of like what I want to do. So yeah, I don't know. It was definitely risky, but it's just kind of, it made sense to me. And yeah, I don't know. I think, yeah, casting and this script though, it lent itself to kids a lot better than a different script could. I mean, since it's so action-based and light humor and stuff. And it's like, cause if it was a drama, heavy drama film, that would have been a different story. I would not have done that. But yeah, I just, so.
Well, and it worked out brilliantly. The kids really are great. Everyone that I've seen the movie with really, really loves the performances from all the kids. And even like, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that people talk about a lot, and this is what people were talking to you about at Cannes, this is what people, you know, is like, this kid who plays Jody that I think everyone loves, that I love every line he says is one of my favorite lines in the movie. But like, I remember working on the movie and thinking to myself, what is he going to do about this kid? Cause I thought he was the cutest little kid and he was so like funny and energetic and awesome, but I couldn't understand probably 75% of the words that he was saying. And yeah. I thought, well, he's got, Weston's got his work cut out for him here. And I think that this, like, we talked about like how like I had to step in and play Dana and we had to sort of adjust that and stuff and all these different things that happen in the process of being in principal photography and being like, we can't stop and reconfigure. We have to work on the fly. This is another one of those things. There's a lot of things where you just had to sort of like improvise and adapt. And this is one of those things that I think really, really worked in the movie's favor, weirdly. So can you talk about like,
yeah,
all that?
Sure.
Yeah,
that's definitely like one of the most like it's yeah, no, it's, it was a huge thing. So yeah, Jody, Skylar Peters, who plays Jody, he was the only kid, the only tape that made me laugh, like of all the kids, only one who made me laugh just naturally. And so I was like, I have to give a callback to this kid. We met for the callback and he was super nervous. And I was like, he was barely speaking. And I was just like, I was just asking him questions. I kind of like, we were in a park with his family and Jeff Johnson, the casting director. And I was just like, sat down, I was asking him questions. I was like, and he was just like giving me one word answers. And I knew, I was like, he's just nervous because it's like an audition. And I knew that if I gave him the role, he wouldn't be nervous. So then I did. I was like, you know what? You got it, kid. You got the role. And then he like just jumped up and he was like doing cartwheels and stuff. And I was like, yeah, this is it. Like, this is the kid. So yeah. It was really like, he was just like, it was like just running and all his like physical stuff was like what I was like, this will work. And then I didn't really, we rehearsed one scene like a few days before shooting, but he only had a couple lines in it. And I just didn't really pay attention to it. And then, yeah, the first day of shooting, he was not understandable at all. And I was like, he was mumbling. And I was like, okay, I think he might be a little nervous. So then I was like, okay, just, so he'd be like, hey, so what are you going to go to power, you know? And I'd be like, oh, maybe just talk. I was like, can you do it louder? And he'd be like, hey, so go down. And I was like, oh no. And then, yeah, I had a huge moment of panic and I'm like, okay, I guess we just have to shoot it. I mean, it was like, what else in like could I have done in that day? So I was like, we're just going to shoot it. But I cut a lot of his lines out. It was the scene at Celia's house, the baker's house, all those scenes outside and at the door. And I cut out a ton of his lines that were there. And I was kind of like, came down to like, okay, anyways. Yeah, at the end of the day, I was mortified. I had really messed up. And I had no idea what to do. And I was really going to pull the plug on the movie because I just didn't know.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. Not just because of that, but because the first day of shooting was really, really terrible. Every first day on set is like pretty wonky, but this, it was like, I thought I had set us up for disaster with how, because it was a 20-day shoot and the script was like 110 pages. So it was like 7 pages a day or 8 pages a day. with kids shooting, like, we really only get 6 hours with the kids. So the pace we were moving at was just not really conducive to, like, making something that's watchable. And so by the end of that day, I was really mortified, and I was going to pull the plug, but then I decided, well, we're all here. Everyone's here. I'm going to give one more day. And if the next day isn't a little bit better, I'm going to pull the plug. And that was the second day, which you were at, which was, it was better. It was better than the first day, by a lot better, but still not, like, incredible. But then the third day we went up to the mountains, and the kids, they emerged from the truck, and then they do the wrestling. And it was the first time the makeup artist had got them dirty and filthy. And I was like, and then that's when I was like, okay, this is it. Like, this is the movie. This is, like,
I love the scene when they get out of the truck. And I also love the scene of the four kids in the meadow
together. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. But then I that day I was like, okay, I saw the movie. And then, so I think on the second day, first night, I decided, I was like, if I subtitle Jody, it will be funny. Then it will work.
But also, it's interesting how you said you had to cut lines for him, because his lines are always, like, the most eloquent of all three of the kids. If it's almost like that convention of subtitling this kid who almost always delivers the punchline in this very eloquent way. If he had too many lines, the convention could sort of wear itself out. So it's like everything sort of winds up working.
Absolutely. I had to give a lot to Hazel, though, because, for example, Jody, he was supposed to do the campfire scene where Jody was supposed to sneak in and, like, steal the eggs, because Jody was going to be the hungry one. He was always hungry and stuff. But you got to roll with it. You got to roll with all the, that's directing, you know. You kind of have to roll with the waves and the punches and everything, and just kind of, like, figure it out. Yeah.
What's with Yeah Baby?
So Yeah Baby, it's like a thing that my friend, I have this friend group here in LA that's like our catchphrase. It was like, we just said Yeah Baby a lot. There's like a GIF on Instagram that's like a blinking Yeah Baby GIF that we made t-shirts with it. And the guy I wanted to cast as John Redrye was one of my friends, where we would say Yeah Baby all the time. So it was just kind of like an inside joke almost.
I don't think I noticed it. I don't think I noticed it till the second time I saw it. And then I was like, they say Yeah Baby, like, all the time.
Yeah, all the time.
That was really funny. And then one of my favorite lines that you have in the entire movie, for the listening audience, you're also in the film. One of my favorite lines that you have is when you go, "Hey, maybe do a little dance with it."
A little dance with it, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
That's so good. Maybe do a little dance with it. I don't know.
I mean,
funny. It is crazy. Like, that's what I'm talking about. It's like when you have that feeling of, like, oh shit, like day one, like, oh man, I might be in over my head. That's that, like, pressure. Like the stakes are high with filmmaking, because this is a very expensive art project, even when it's technically low budget. You've gotten a lot of people to give you a lot of money to make this thing, and you get there day one and it's like, oh no, everyone's here and everyone's looking at me for the answer, and I think I might have put us in a situation that's a no-win situation. Maybe I could get everyone their money back if we stop now. But I'm so impressed with how many things there were like that the movie that you knew to just lean into. And that's what I mean, there's so many things in this film that I'm just like, and again, it goes back to, like, the few reviews that didn't like the movie. We'll talk about sort of like, oh, it just seems like they didn't really maybe give these kids enough takes on some of these takes. It feels like the kids are just sort of like figuring out the line as they're saying it. And I'm like, I personally, stylistically, like watching a performance from a kid that's not so polished.
Oh, because I hate it. Yeah.
Those kids to me feel like real kids. And there's a stylistic thing where I'm just like, I don't know. It all seems to be a part of the overall charm and aesthetic of the film that really winds up, to me, working in the film's favor instead of being like a hindrance. And it's like, I wouldn't want really slick, polished, like Hollywood kid performances, you know?
Yeah. No, I like how handmade the whole thing turned out, you know? It has a real handmade kid-like feel to it, which, yeah, so... kind of works, you know, and film, you know, in my opinion, shooting on 16 millimeter really softens a lot of that too. I think in my opinion, acting just tends to look better on film. Everything looks, production design looks better on film. It just, it sort of just is like, it has this magical gauze or something that digital doesn't. Like digital, you just see everything so clearly. Like you, I don't know, there isn't like a kind of mask over the like suspension of disbelief. So yeah,
totally. I mean, it's so hard to people always want to say references. They always want to be like, oh, Goonies or Stand By Me or just whatever their like reference point to, like a child's movie that has a little bit of edge or a little bit of bite to it.
Yeah.
But then I saw someone that said something, I think on Letterboxd, that was like, I don't know how to describe this, but this movie makes me nostalgic for something I've actually never seen before. And it's like, that's what it feels like to me, is I'm like, cool. There's an energy that's making me go, oh yeah, this feels like something I watched growing up, but at the same time, it's unlike anything that I watched growing up.
Oh, yeah.
And that is really cool. But also, like, I like that the movie's got a little bit of an edge to it. I like that the movie's got bite. I like that there are adults smoking cigarettes and that one of the kids drops the F-bomb. Like, I like this stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, me too. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I called it a hard PG-13. That was like what I would refer to it as, yeah, throughout the filmmaking, I guess. You know that the MPAA, they wanted to rate it R for the drinking, for Hazel drink, for child alcohol use. And I was always aiming for PG-13. I was like, and it has to be PG-13 because it is that kind of like kid movie and adult movie that kind of hits that weird crossover. But I sent them a huge list of movies that had like kids drinking alcohol and stuff. So luckily we got the PG-13.
Again, some of the reviews that I looked at were like, who's this for? Like, it's too adult for kids. And it's, and I was like, and I was like, I watched lots of kids movies growing up that had an edge to them. Like Sandlot has a whole scene where all the kids are taking plugs of tobacco and they puke all over everybody at the, you know, like,
yeah, it's one of the best scenes like in the movie. Yeah. I miss that. I miss a lot of that from, I mean, nowadays, yeah, you just don't really see that anymore. And like, yeah, it's so like fun, honestly, to watch. And it's also just like a part of, like childhood, you're like wondering like what is alcohol, like what the, I don't know, like in old Disney movies like Davy Crockett, they would like drink like concoctions of booze and we're always like, what is, I don't know, it was just funny, honestly,
right?
Like I don't know, and like it's good for storytelling, it's just like good for movies and stuff, so
absolutely.
Yeah, but and I love that thing of like, who is this for? And what's been so cool about the movie is that it's played at horror film festivals and it's played at children's film festivals and like everything in between and stuff. But I'll also just say too, like speaking of that, I did make the movie for me though. Like that is also just talking about directing in general. I am the audience. Like it was purely for me, and I needed to make something that, and I think that's the one thing that like any director should do, writer, director, is like make sure that you are making something that is, that you are going to love, and a movie that you will want to watch no matter what, because it, and not trying to make it for someone else.
I think in indie filmmaking, you see it way too often that someone is trying to make a film that they think they can sell, that they think that like this is like what market analysis says they can probably sell as a first time director. So they're writing as every part of the process is like they're gearing their screenplay, they're gearing all of their ideas toward what they think they can entice investors with. And I'm like, sure, that's probably got to play some kind of part in it, but really the most important thing, I think you just nailed it, is like, would you want, is this a movie that you're excited about? Is this something that you as the filmmaker want to watch? And I think that's what really works about your movie, is that it's like, it has such a unique personality to it, but because of that, because we can feel that the filmmaker is so confident in what they're doing and likes what they're doing, we like it. You know,
yeah, totally, for sure, for sure. I did always think though that the audience, it could be like a Napoleon Dynamite type movie where it's sort of like, yeah, the first it's very polarizing, and the first reaction is like, what is this? But then people, once they're kind of on the bandwagon, it could be like, yeah, this is like kind of weird and new, and I don't know, but it has enough charm to like be watchable or something. So that's what we were always like pushing it as, like when we're selling it to distributors and stuff. Like I was always like, it's in the Napoleon Dynamite realm. So
yeah. You grew up in Park City, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, we're Utah boys. Does that come into your writing a lot, like mountain towns and stuff like that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I'd say like 90% of my scripts are set in the mountains, in the forests, in the woods, specifically like pine trees. Pine trees are my favorite trees, and I love pine tree forests. There's just something really magical and fun and enchanting about them. But I grew up on the mountain, so it was my backyard. But I have several mountain adventure movies, in the pipeline. Where Salt Lake or where?
I was in Sandy, which is just like a suburb of Salt Lake. But yeah, the runoff from Little Cottonwood Canyon, the river went right through my backyard. So I had that sort of thing with my friends of like going out and like getting lost in. Mm-hmm. We had such an amazing little playground, as I'm sure you did too, growing up, to be like, it's right there. Me and my friends can go get lost, and we can build forts out there, and
did that. Yeah. My whole childhood. Absolutely. And it was so nice to come home to make my first movie. It just felt like really, really comfortable, you know, like playing on the home field or something, you know, and just like, a lot of locations I'd already kind of knew. And so it was just, at least I have, this was one of the small advantages of making my first movie, was that.
Now that the movie is made, edited, it's done festivals, it did Cannes and Toronto. I talked about this at the talkback I did in Salt Lake, but it's like, there's like five festivals that everybody knows, and it's Venice, Cannes, Toronto, Sundance, and like maybe Tribeca or the New York Film Festival. And we did two of them, which is huge. And now it's having this run in theaters, and audiences are getting to see it and enjoy it. What's this process been like for you? Do you feel a sense of relief that it's working out, or do you still feel this like tension of like, we got to get it to more, like what's this been like for you?
Oh yeah. It's been truly wonderful and such a relief. The editing process was really long and really lonely and dark. And I really was worried about the fate of the movie. And to have it premiere at Cannes, I mean, the dream of dreams, my dream being accomplished, like it was absolutely amazing. And I felt incredible relief, incredible gratitude. That month of the May of 2023 was like the best month of my life. It was so much fun, so cool. So beautiful to have all the cast come, a lot of the crew came, my parents, my family. It was such a beautiful experience. So nice. And then, the festival circuit was amazing. My second favorite was Sitges in Catalonia in Spain. By Barcelona. It's a beach town. It's kind of like Cannes a little bit. It was a beautiful, beautiful festival. It's been incredible. And then, I went to Denver with the twins where they live and got to see it with their family. And then, many more. Now the theatrical release and everything, but it's been a full-time job still. This past year has been a ton of work. I'm severely exhausted right now. But I'm going to France again. I'm going to France on Friday for like a 2.5 week tour, of like cities, ending in Paris for the last week. They're having like another big red carpet premiere for the theatrical release in Paris.
Wow.
But then after at the end of April will kind of be when I'm kind of done with all the promotions and like finally kind of done. But then it might go to Japan in November for the Japanese release.
Wow.
That's going to be cool. They're making a lot of merch, and they make the company that bought it, the distributor in Japan, is really cool. I love them so much, and they make really good merch. So I'm psyched to see cool. what they do. Yeah, yeah.
I want one of those shirts. I need one of those. The Riddle, the crew shirt that everybody.
You should have got one. Yeah, that was the crew. That was the production shirt. I hastily drew it on, like, it was the second to last day of shooting at the house. It was during lunch, and like they were like, the costume department were like, we need to make a shirt, can you just draw some? And I was like, yeah. All the kids were like looking over me and like adding things onto it. It was really funny. Yeah,
that's awesome. The movie is available for people to buy or rent on digital, like on, you know, like iTunes or whatever. Yeah. When is that
Apple,
happening?
Amazon, April 12th. Yeah.
Okay. Very
April
soon. 12th.
Very soon. Yeah. Yeah. It'll be out. Yeah. You can own it and rent it. Yeah. Apple, Amazon, the other Google Play, YouTube. I think you can. Yeah.
April 12th, 2024. If you're listening to this sometime in the future or it's already happened, you can go right now.
Yeah.
And go watch it. You should. Riddle of Fire, written and directed by Weston Rizzulli.
Starring Austin Archer.
With a little cameo from Austin Archer. Really, really great movie. I mean that sincerely. I'm just so proud of it, and I'm so impressed with the work that you did, Weston. What are you doing next? I know that you've got another project in the works, and what's happening with that?
Yeah, so it's a crime film, a Eurocrime film. It's a script that it's based off a short film I actually made a long time ago in Barcelona. I wrote the script kind of from October last year, from October to this year till end of January. So the first draft is done. I'm planning to kind of do the rewrite, hopefully a little bit while I'm in France next week, kind of on the train, riding trains and stuff. I love to write on trains if I can. So I'm going to try to start the rewrite then. But yeah, it's a Eurocrime romance film set in Spain and France. And it's kind of it's a bit different. It's a hard R crime film.
Do you feel like you got the idea while you were out in Spain and France doing festivals?
Well, it's based on a short film that I made years ago in Barcelona. It was from a little script that I wrote, and so I've kind of over the past years I've written notes and notes and notes about these characters and kind of developed this story. But yeah, so that's the next project. But I also have several other scripts too that are kind of in the pipeline that are more on the Riddle of Fire kind of like adventure films. But
yeah,
this next one just kind of feels right for some reason to do next.
Well, I sure hope I get to send you a tape for the next one.
I do too.
Yeah.
Please do.
Absolutely. Cool, man. Is there anything else you want to talk about with your movie, or do you feel good?
I feel great. It's been a pleasure to be on the podcast, man. Yeah. I really feel fortunate to have had you in the film too. Like I love watching you every time I see the movie. You're one of my favorite parts of the movie. You're so funny, and like you play that character so much better than I could have ever written it, with like such humor and weirdness and uniqueness. So I really love your performance like so much. And so does everybody mentioned too. So.
Well, I appreciate it. I really, really mean it. I really am just so impressed with this movie, and I'm so excited to see what you do next. And just, I'm such a big fan. So thanks for doing it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cool, man.
Alrighty. Yeah, alrighty. Baby.
Yeah, baby. Talk
yeah,
to you
baby.
Soon.
Bye-bye. Yeah, baby. Bye-bye. Yeah, baby. Indeed. How cool is that, right? You know, there's a good chance that Weston Rizzulli's film career is going to take off, and you'll get to say, hey, I listened to this guy on a podcast back when he was promoting his very first film, and very few people knew who he was, but there were a small handful of people who saw the potential. And I listened to that podcast, and I said, I'm going to go watch that movie. I'm going to go get that movie on digital, because it's available now. And I went and watched it, and I said, yep, this guy's going to be somebody. This guy's going to be a mover and a shaker in the film industry, and you'll be in on the ground floor. How cool will that be, right? Don't you want that? Don't you want that clout? You should. All right, that's Weston Rizzulli. Go watch Riddle of Fire. It's available wherever you are. If you've got access to iTunes, you can get it. You can go watch it. All right? So go check it out. And then let me know what you think. Okay? People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com, austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, or by looking up Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music. Hey, my double vinyl is still available at austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. If you haven't picked that up, what are you doing? Go get it. Go get it. There are like 120 copies left of that thing that I have to sell, and we have way more than 120 people that listen to this podcast every week. So go pick up Beautiful Things, the deluxe edition, the limited edition double vinyl over at austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. And if you don't want to do that, if vinyl's not your thing, go check out patreon.com/austinarcher if you want to help support this show and everything that we're doing here. We would love to have you. Shout out to all my Patreon patrons. Wind Beneath My Wings, love you more than I can say. We'll see you next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Love you so much. Bye-bye.